I think we'll get started. My name is Travis. I'm the Village Naturalist, and today the session will be sort of co-led by me and Neil Weedham, who is very, very knowledgeable about grizzlies from his experience in Glacier National Park and just being around it a lot. I've had a grand total of one grizzly bear encounter since I've been recreating out in the wilderness. I've had probably over 100 black bear encounters just since being at Holden. So I'm familiar with bears, but I'm not super familiar with grizzlies. So he'll provide sort of that expertise today, which is great. But we're gonna go over basically the proposal that the National Park Service has put out to reintroduce the grizzly bear into the North Cascades ecosystem. And for all the Montanans in the room, that's very interesting because you've probably not had to do that. You've already had the grizzly bear around and you've just had to restore their populations. But the great thing about having this discussion with all of you present is that you're very familiar with grizzlies and can give us some great context for what that would look like here in this ecosystem. So just before we get started, a reminder that this session is recorded. So if you want to chip in comments, which will create a space at the end for some discussion, just note that you'll be recorded for all folks in the internet to listen to, which is also very cool. So, beginning with just kind of an overview of what the grizzly bear is. The grizzly bear is a bear species that is distributed all over the Northern Hemisphere. And within our particular range, we've got both grizzlies and black bears that exist in sort of North America, and in this range, in the North Cascades, we've got, I think the estimate I've been told is about 10,000 black bears distributed across the North Cascades ecosystem, which is about 6 million plus acres, so big space. Grizzly bears are a lot bigger than black bears, or can be. Males can be between 300 and 700 pounds, that's sort of the average. Females are basically about half that size. They can live up to 30 years if they're healthy and fit. And they range over a really long space. So they can go between 800 and 2,000 square miles within their lifetime of sort of where they will move around. And within the North Cascades, it's a little bit different than Montana. Montana, the valleys are a lot wider, and folks can kind of cruise. If you're a bear, you can kind of move over those ranges much easier, whereas here, the mountains are so jagged, the valleys are so narrow that usually that range would be spread sort of more vertically over a longer distance, which is kind of an interesting difference. The females don't range as far in comparison to the males. And just a fun fact, they can run up to 45 miles per hour. It's fascinating. If you look at the comparison between a black bear and a grizzly, you can see there's a difference in the claw length and shape. Black bears have a much smaller claw. Their print is a little bit different. The black bear's, basically its thumb, if you will, is sort of back behind the first four appendages. You can see that print there. Whereas the grizzly has them all sort of forward. The grizzly bear has sort of short ears and a little bit more of a dished face. So it's a little bit flatter as opposed to sort of a more pointed face with the black bear. And then there's a really sort of characteristic hump that a lot of grizzlies have on their back that distinguishes them. Though black bears often are black, there's also many different colors to black bears. I've seen bears in this valley that are black bears that have the same coloration as a grizzly. I've seen cinnamon bears. I've seen ones that look brown. So it's not just to say that, oh, I've seen a bear that's not black, so it must be a grizzly. There's a lot of other factors at play.
Just a point to make.
I can turn down just a little bit.
Color-wise, grizzlies can be such a wide range of color. Also, we have a grizzly at Two Medicine that is pure black. There's not a spot of white or brown on him. He weighs about 600 to 650 pounds. We also have a smaller female with a cub who who is, she is almost as blonde can be. So it's not white, but it's a yellowish, and across the center of her body, we call it a girth strap, is the girth strap itself is dark brown. So she's a very strange looking bear. So color phases, it's something that when people come in descriptively and tell us the color, we have to bring out a picture for them to look at, because they'll say brown, but brown comes in a multitude of different phases, from really a blonde brown to such a dark brown that it looks black, and then our black grizzly, which is the only one we've ever seen. So color-wise, the variety is just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and that presents a difficulty, as we'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation, when trying to figure out confirmed sightings of grizzlies, because there is so much variability, and it's sometimes difficult to distinguish. Like, I've had probably a couple dozen guests this summer who swear that they saw a grizzly bear when they were out on the trail. And the likelihood of that, based on the data we have, is like very, 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 very unlikely that they actually saw it. They might have, but it's just tough to have those confirmed sightings. So this is just an example of what a mature grizzly looks like. This is in a sagebrush area. And you can just see, I mean, if you've been around sagebrush, it's a pretty big animal. and you can see, you know, the distinctive hump on the back there, with the short ears and that disc face really well from this angle.
What's the height of them when they're on all fours and then when they get up on their hind legs?
When they're on their hind legs, people will tell you that they are 12 feet tall. But 7 feet, 7.5 feet is very typical. When they're on all fours, they're from, obviously from here up to a big boar will be about this size. The largest boar that I ever worked was 1,200 pounds. It was called the Guyford Grizzly, and his standing shoulder was almost 4 feet.
Thank you.
Massive, massive head. He's very good at opening cabin doors.
So a little bit about sort of the habitat that grizzlies prefer. I'll talk about it on the next slide, but they eat a huge variety of different foods. And so because of that, they have different preferences depending on season. So if you're at the beginning of the season, sort of, you know, May through July, they're going to prefer different habitats than the end. And sort of the top here is kind of their preferred, the number one, and as you go down, it gets to their least preferred habitat. So like a montane meadow, you know, higher elevation, that'd be like Cloudy Pass or something like that within our ecosystem. A deciduous forest a couple down would be, you know, like if you're going on the way up to Heart Lake, there's a big area where you've got alder and aspen and some cottonwood and things like that, that you have quite a few different foods. Then there's like a dry forest, which is really what we have around here. It's a pretty dry Douglas fir forest. And then, you know, a low elevation shrub would be like, we're sort of on the edge of the Cascades getting into shrubland. And it's sort of similar, but a slightly different preference later on in the season. So what do grizzlies eat? Very similar in some ways to black bears. I think I've got a natural history book for the North Cascades, and when you open up and start reading about bears, they say bears are our cousins because they have 5 appendages on their hands and they eat the same diet spread as we do. So they're omnivores. They eat plants, fish, they'll eat different meats, they'll eat kind of all sorts of things that they pick out of the ground. So ungulates is like deer, elk, things of that nature. Small mammals, so like martens, rabbits, other ground squirrels, things like that. Fish, you know, a lot of people when they think of bears, they think of like pond at the salmon run in Alaska. So that, depending on the population of those bears, could be a big part of the diet. Roots, it's kind of funny. I was sitting on the hike house porch in like late May, and I heard just a whole bunch of splashing down sort of between the creek and the porch. I looked down and there was a black bear, obviously not a grizzly, but it was just splashing around in the water, pulling out all of these sort of watered down plants and ripping them out and eating the bulbs, which are full of sugar at that time of the year because they're sending in all these new stalks. So, you know, they'll be in that sort of habitat, which obviously if it's sort of a flooded area and they're eating those type of roots, that's a very different habitat than maybe a higher sort of shrub or berry field. So it's a huge spread, and depending on the population in the area, bears might eat a totally different set of things, right? If you're really relying on salmon runs in Alaska, that bear population might take a huge percentage of its diet from fish. Whereas if you're in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, it might be a totally different spread of what is being consumed. So in that way, bears are actually quite adaptable to different ecosystems, kind of can work with different foods.
Right now in Glacier, as the bears are here, they're in a state called hyperphagia, where they're intent on, depending on the size of the bear, consuming 20 to 40,000 calories per day. So they're feeding 20, 21 hours a day and catnapping. So they'll feed for an hour or two, take a 15-minute catnap, go back to feeding. And right now, in Glacier in particular, we have a phenomenal service berry crop. Our huckleberries didn't even huckle this year. you could find them, but because we had no moisture, we had 16 hundredths of an inch of moisture in 3 months. The huckleberries don't have any, never developed any sugar. But the, service berries for some reason just absolutely exploded. The other thing that the grizzlies are feeding on right now, very high on mountains, even the highest mountains in the park, are army cutworm moths, and they will go into a scree slope, and it literally looks like it's been bombed. There will be holes that are in the scree that are 3 and 4 feet deep, and the grizzlies are just throwing down the army cutworm moth, 1 calorie at a time. Mm-hmm. That's what they get, and they will eat 10 to 15,000 cutworm moths a day. So that's delicious. One thing that I don't think you see here with black bear, but grizzlies will also eat they're cannibalistic. They will eat a boar in particular will run down a cub and kill it and eat it. If it has a chance to kill a black bear in a fight, it will feed on that black bear for several days. So they're so dependent on gaining weight that everything becomes a source of food. Omnivore is definitely a appropriate definition.
Yeah. So within our particular range, this is an image of what is characterized as basically the North Cascades ecosystem. So essentially from I-90, when it cuts over to Seattle, up to the Canadian border, and then a couple hundred miles north of there is that encompassed area. So it's a huge area, and we are basically right in the middle of it, right here, this area, right where Holden is. And obviously the North Cascades National Park, which is doing this proposal, also is. So when you think about sort of this range, historically, there's evidence that this was a part of the Grizzly Bear Range. At the time of Lewis and Clark's exploration of the West, folks estimate that there was about 50,000 grizzly bears spread across that whole territory. And I'll talk about it on the next slide, but there's a couple of lines of evidence that kind of get us to that number. It seems kind of like, how do you get it? But we'll get there. So the last bears that were spotted in the United States part of this ecosystem was in 1996. So there may have been other bear sightings, but those were the last times that that was confirmed by biologists who had enough evidence to suggest, yes, this was a grizzly bear. Whereas there's lots and lots of people since then who have claimed that they've seen a grizzly. There are two confirmed individuals, two grizzly bears, that are in British Columbia, just on the other side of the border from basically Ross Lake. And they've been monitoring them, but they haven't been able to find any other bears. And I think they're both females, so there's not really much hope of getting a population established from that. Another big thing about it is that when you look at the habitat in the North Cascades, it's really great habitat for the bears. But north of this ecosystem, south of this ecosystem, east of this ecosystem, there's been so much habitat fragmentation from logging, urban expansion, things like that, that basically the ecologists say other bears aren't going to be able to migrate into this ecosystem. You'd have to basically bring them here. They won't naturally come because there's too many obstructions in the way and not enough food. Again, the characterization of this is that there's a lot of wilderness areas that would make sort of prime habitat for those grizzlies. So what's the evidence? A lot of people who are opponents of the proposal say, oh, well, the grizzlies weren't here anyways, right? There's no evidence that they existed in the North Cascades ecosystem. That's not exactly factual. There's been lots of claimed observations. Those are hard to tell. Before sort of modern times, there's a lot of pictures of definite grizzly bears in the North Cascades. So early photos of folks kind of exploring the ecosystem and taking images that are definitely authentic grizzly bears. The biggest one, though, is pelt counts. So when a lot of the fur trading companies came in from Europe, they did a huge cataloging effort to figure out when all the pelts were coming back through the shipping lines, what species they were. And so they have actually a really rich and accurate catalog of all of the grizzly bear pelts that they've taken from this specific area. So through reading those logs, we've learned kind of that, hey, there was a substantial population here. The last one is archaeological evidence. So within sort of this historic range, there is a lot of archaeological evidence from the North Cascades, basically sites where there is a settlement, and then there are skeletons of animals. And they found tons of grizzly bear skeletons. So, I mean, just try and visualize, do you really think that a native tribe is going to trade a grizzly bear from a super, super long ways away and have it, like, bound up in little leather ties and transfer that grizzly bear over hundreds and thousands of miles to get to this location? Or do you think that they would have killed that here? It's very, very unlikely that they brought it from somewhere else. So that's another big line of evidence to suggest that, hey, there was a bear population here, thus we should reintroduce them. So from the North Cascades National Park's perspective, they have an obligation to prevent the extinction of an endangered species legally. So, I mean, the big one for them is that they want to avoid the permanent loss of the grizzly in the North Cascades ecosystem. They also are really interested in sort of contributing to the biodiversity by adding in another big species that has a lot of prey and habit and sort of plant relations in terms of what it's eating and how it's changing the environment. They really want to introduce that for the purpose of biological diversity. And also the enjoyment of people. That's a big aim of the Park Service, is to facilitate us getting into nature and experiencing it. So, you know, their belief is that by reintroducing the bear, then we're providing greater enjoyment. Obviously, if you're reintroducing bears, you're going to increase the probability that they're going to survive in this ecosystem and not go extinct in this area. And the eventual hope would be to delist the bear from the endangered species list. So the Yellowstone population just had that happen this summer, and there's a lot of contention over, well, is the population really healthy enough to take it off the list and open it up to hunting? Or is it a big victory for conservation to say, wow, that population's in great shape, and delisting it is something that we want to aim for, right? Just like delisting the bald eagle was a huge accomplishment from conservationist perspectives, that's kind of what you want to aim for, is to have a big enough population where you can take it off of the endangered species list. But that's one of the big pushes. So what are the benefits and costs? This is kind of what the Park Service put out, but basically they say, you know, the benefits are you're restoring the natural and cultural heritage, you're enabling residents in the Pacific Northwest to experience a grizzly in its natural habitat, you're supporting tribal values and heritage in the region. A lot of the native animals in the area have significant spiritual meaning to the local tribes. So, I mean, by reintroducing an important species, you're sort of giving those tribes your support. Some of the costs, one of them is cost to wilderness characters. What does that mean? Wilderness character is your experience in the wilderness, right? That you expect to be out in the wilderness and not have a helicopter fly overhead. Well, in order to reintroduce the bear, that's a potential cost. They're going to have to do a lot of flight trips via helicopter in to monitor the bears, to actually bring the bears into the remote location and release them. And that was one of their potential drawbacks, was having that sort of hampering of wilderness character by doing all those flights. Not everyone in the Northwest wants to see a grizzly bear. So that's a potential cost too, is really people have different opinions about how they feel about bears. And they may not want to see a grizzly bear or perceive it to be more aggressive. Another one is human-bear interactions. If you introduce grizzly bears, you're increasing the chance that humans will interact with grizzly bears. So whether or not that's a bad thing, I mean, there's already lots of bear interactions anyways, but that's just a cost that they're thinking about. And then a big cost, actually, from a conservation perspective, is taking bears from other populations. In order to introduce them, you've got to bring them from other populations, which means you're potentially impacting those source populations. All those populations would be from the American West, so Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, sort of the big grizzly bear population centers. There's, I think, six areas that are thought of as grizzly bear habitat in the West.
Can I just make a comment? Can you go back to that last slide? Under costs, you look at the third word, wilderness. To me, this, what we have here at Holden and in the North Cascades, is a wild area. But you look at the first six words in wilderness, and to me, what you create is a wilder area once you introduce the grizzly. The difference between wild and wilder. The grizzly makes Glacier Park a much wilder area than the North Cascades. And I think the introduction of the grizzly into the North Cascades will change its complexion to some degree, but will turn it into a true wilderness. A small play on words.
So next I'll just go through the different alternatives, and then we can talk about what y'all think. So there's four different options that the park has suggested. The first is alternative A, no action. They always have a no action alternative, which is just, we're not going to do anything, And hopefully somehow bears will come from other populations and reestablish themselves and not go extinct. The costs and benefits, very unlikely that you'd have grizzly bears coming back into the North Cascades if you did nothing. So you're probably not going to see any of the benefits or costs. You're just not going to have bears and consequently won't fulfill your obligation to keeping them from going extinct in this area. Alternative B is to introduce bears, and they use this fancy phrase, ecosystem evaluation restoration, and the basic idea is that they would just introduce a few bears to begin with. They'd try and aim for about 10 bears that they'd be taking from other populations and introducing into the North Cascades over 2 years. And then they'd take another 2 years and say, okay, how'd it go? What are the costs? What are the benefits? Are the bears running out of the hills down into the orchards and causing all sorts of problems? Are people adapting? Is it really great? Are they really, you know, surviving well and reproducing? Is the population going well? Kind of look at all the different ways in which people are viewing it and see how it goes. Then, at that point, they'd either let that population continue to slowly grow or consider doing some of the other alternatives in addition to this. The idea is that every alternative wants to get to 200 bears. That's the minimum population that they see as basically being what we can let them go on their own. We don't have to monitor. Once you get that 200 bears, you've got enough breeding pairs. You've got enough offspring coming out that population will sustain itself within this ecosystem. That's the hope. And they expect that if they do this alternative, it'll take between 60 to 100 years to get 200 bears in the North Cascades. So that's quite a long time in the eyes of a lot of conservationists. And if for some reason they were to introduce 10 bears and say half of them died that winter, then the following year they'd get back up to 10 so that they've always got that minimum population to work with. But they wouldn't add tons and tons of bears beyond that. The benefits of this is it's a really precautionary approach. They sort of want to wait and see what happens, and then after a few years, if it's successful, really, you know, maybe consider expediting that recovery. Otherwise, if things don't go well, then they can choose to not pursue it any further. The big bonus about this, too, is that it's not having a huge impact on other populations because you're only taking a few bears to start with instead of a lot. The third alternative, alternative C, is incremental restoration. Which is very similar, it's just more bears to start with. So basically every year they add 5 to 7 bears into the North Cascades and they get that up to 25. And the idea is that once you get 25, then that will really speed up the process and they'll just sort of take care of themselves. We don't have to keep introducing bears. That population will maintain itself until it gets to 200 and then we can totally retract from the reintroduction process. They would only, again, reintroduce, like add more bears into the mix to maintain that 25 to just let it grow. They expect that this would also take between 60 to 100 years. Why is it the same number? They basically have a window where if, you know, lots of bears dies and we have tons of years where there are bad ecological conditions that don't favor grizzly bears, then you might take a much longer time to get that population up. Whereas if it's like, whoa, we got bumper crops of berries every year and it's not too long of a snowpack, and there's plenty of food and moisture, and they're breeding with one another really easily, great, then it might take less time. It just depends. And again, this is still a relatively low impact on source populations. You're not taking as many bears from other ecosystems right away. You're still being precautionary, but you're speeding up the process a little bit in terms of how you're going to sort of restore that bear population. And again, this is just a graph that shows the time that it would take, the number of bears, and you know, with the same starting point of about 25, if the conditions are not great and they have trouble reproducing, it might take a much longer period than if everything kind of goes perfectly. So probably in reality, the time that it would take would be somewhere in between there. Alternative D is what they call expedited recovery. Basically, they add 5 to 7 bears every year until they get to 200 and want to do that really quickly. So instead of stopping at 25 and just letting that population grow, they would just keep adding bears until you get to that 200 bear population. They expect that would take about 25 years to get to the 200 bears, so much, much, much shorter than the other options. In terms of the cost and benefits, you've got a quick realization of all of those right away because you're getting the bear population restored very quickly. And one of the negatives that they sort of point out is that this would have a pretty big impact on source populations because you'd be taking a lot of bears from other ecosystems. So how that would impact those populations in places like the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, you know, it would probably be a bigger impact. And obviously, because they just continuously be adding bears, that window is a lot smaller. If they were to, say, add, you know, 5 to 7 bears the first year, and then 3 of them were to die, well, not only would they add 5 to 7 bears the next year, but they'd also add 3 to replace the ones that died, to keep that ramping up. So it would just be like a very, you know, rapid incremental increase to get that population up. So this is just some thoughts. And Neil, you should definitely chime in on this, like, because you've experienced the expansion of the populations in Montana. But you know, the impacts on the ecosystem are variable. The first one is predation, and you know, grizzlies, as I understand, eat a little bit of a wider palate because they're a little bit of a bigger animal. They'll still think. Neil was sort of discussing that they don't do as much like killing, but they'll do a lot of scavenging of different animals, like elk and deer and things like that. But elk and deer are still pretty formidable opponents to them. This. Another consideration is competition. So a lot of people think, well, we've already got black bears, right? If we introduce the grizzly bear, won't they overlap? Won't it push black bears out? There's a lot of studies that have shown that although they do have overlapping diets and habitat, grizzlies will also tend to be out in the open a little bit more than black bears will, and sort of browse through a variety of habitats that black bears don't occupy. So there's sort of different niches in that way. So you might not have as much competition as would be anticipated. And then the other question is like umbrella species. And I don't know, maybe Neil, you want to talk about that, because you had mentioned that a little bit.
An umbrella species is, if you look, what does an umbrella do? It protects you against the elements. An umbrella species, in order for an umbrella species to survive, conditions have to be maintained at a survival level. So if the grizzly bear is going to survive, and it has pretty high demand for ideal conditions, air, water, being able to breed, having places where they can form day beds, all of those are considerations under the umbrella. And as long as the umbrella is intact, all the other species are going to survive. We're talking about any of the animals that exist in that area will exist as long as that umbrella stays intact. But you start getting air pollution, that affects the grizzly. You start getting polluted water, that affects the grizzly. As these parts of the umbrella begin to break down, it affects all of the species that were protected under that umbrella. So in Glacier, we look at the grizzly as an umbrella species. And as long as we maintain the umbrella, the other species that exist under that umbrella will survive.
And like the canary in the mine type of thing?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, last slide before we get on to discussion, people are really curious about, obviously, how this would impact Holden. In a couple of ways. So the first is just stewardship, right? So we are stewards of this valley in many ways. We maintain the trails, we engage in the trails, we take logging resources to use as wood in the wintertime and to use in our building products. So we have a relationship with this valley in a big way. And as recreators, any of the costs or benefits that would come from introducing the grizzly bear come on to us, right? So, you know, grizzlies, people's perception is that grizzlies might be more aggressive or more dangerous, or maybe a little bit more willing to kind of stand their ground in relationship to a black bear. So would that mean different, like, you know, patterns of engaging the wilderness? When I go out, I typically make noise in case there is a black bear, but I've had lots and lots of black bear encounters and have never been charged by a black bear, and maybe I've just been lucky, but you know, I think the perception for a lot of folks is that a grizzly would be a little bit more aggressive. Now, whether or not that's true, I think is a really important thing to understand from folks who live in ecosystems where you have both, but the perception is like maybe that would be different. So, you know, do you need to be louder when you're out in the wilderness? Do you need to be bringing bear spray with you, whereas you might not now? Would there be a different change of practice? Another one is our practices, right? Before, we had compost that was outside of buildings and attracted a lot of bears pretty frequently. Well, we maybe were less attentive to making sure that those bears weren't attracted by that scent, because, hey, they're blackbird. We can just scare them away. Not a big deal, right? If we had grizzlies, would that change our practices? Would we have to be more protective and make sure that all of our waste is kind of tucked away and not out and about? Would we have to be really careful about our food scents and things like that? Again, that's, you know, perception versus reality on there. There may be differences. Another one is experience. Obviously, you know, the different alternatives have different frequencies of helicopter flights, so that would change your wilderness character. But I think, like Neil says, might also enhance your wilderness character, because many people might perceive that if there's a grizzly in this population or in this area, it's a more wild place. It's wilder. So that may, you know, be a cost or benefit. Again, backcountry travel, natural heritage, just by having the bear here, I imagine that, you know, if there was a grizzly that was a common sight in the valley, we may have more visitors. There's people who come up here specifically to shoot footage of the birds in spring and autumn, because this is an excellent place to see birds and to go birding. Would we have similar folks coming up to see a grizzly if we knew that there was a grizzly population in the valley? Perhaps. So that might change visitation. On a different token, if our constituency, many of the people are terrified of grizzlies and they know that there's grizzlies in the valley, would they want to come up? Maybe not. It again, perception plays in pretty heavily into how this whole thing would play out.
An interesting point that I'll make with regard to black bear versus grizzlies. Everybody sees the grizzly as that heinous criminal that's going to maul you and drag you off into the brush. If you look at it historically, black bears are vastly more dangerous than grizzlies. The most heinous examples of predation came from black bears.
Is that because there's not more of them?
It's more of them, and black bears will tend to prey on humans, where grizzlies don't prey on humans. There are very, very few examples of grizzlies preying on human beings as a predator would, as a mountain lion would. But there are multiple examples of black bear preying on people. And if you read Stephen Herrero's book Bear Attacks, it will illustrate that over and over and over again. And he will say categorically that black bears are potentially more dangerous as a predator than grizzlies ever will be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one statistic that was shared with me that I found to be interesting was that in 35 years of visitors at Yellowstone National Park, they had 107 million visitors come through the park. And in those 35 years, there were only 35 incidences, injuries, or deaths that was a direct contact between a person and a grizzly bear. And that was all backcountry travel, all roadside travel, all major encounters. And that was, I mean, that just struck me that, like, statistically, even if you're camping in the backcountry in Yellowstone, you're far less likely to have any sort of encounter with a grizzly bear that would be negative or harmful than even with a moose. And way, 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 way less likely to have any sort of harmful encounter than getting in your car. And that perception still really impacts people's feelings about it, I think is kind of interesting. So just kind of as a recap, you've got your, you know, four different alternatives, A, B, C, and D. A is not doing anything. B is introducing just 10 bears to start with and see how that goes. C is let's commit to introducing 5 to 7 bears every year until we get 25. And then the last one is, you know, introduce 5 to 7 bears until you get your 200 and do it as quickly as possible. And I think it would just be interesting for y'all to pitch in on what you think the alternative should be, and maybe at the end of the discussion I can share what the Holden board said in their public comments, because I think it's pretty interesting. Yeah.
I just had a quick, how many hunting permits will there be in Yellowstone now that they're going to start issuing them?
I don't think they've decided that.
I don't think that's
states.
But they will be, they're reintroducing hunting. Isn't that clear? I thought I read that. Would that be a way of taking those bears that would be hunted and transporting them here? Would that be a way of balancing that other negative?
Potentially,
yeah, potentially.
I don't know if that's been discussed. Yeah. They have to make this decision first.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, removing X number of bears from the Yellowstone ecosystem. I just have a bias against the Yellowstone, the bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem because, and you can correct me being a biologist yourself, but I look at the Yellowstone ecosystem as a weak gene pool because they are so isolated. It's like interbreeding as opposed to the greater continental divide ecosystem, which runs all the way from Canada down to the Bob Marshall and skateboard, etc. Here you have a very viable genetic population. So I have a bias against taking bears from Yellowstone. And that may be, it may be not a correct or appropriate assumption, but I'm also a biologist and I just see this gene pool as being a weakened gene pool.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would hope that in whatever alternative they would choose, that would be a huge consideration is what the genetic content is, because if you take bears that all have really identical genes and you put them in the same pool, all it takes is a couple of bears that are susceptible to some sort of illness and that might spread really quickly. Whereas if you're taking from lots of different populations and mixing that gene pool, you're gonna have a greater diversity that will help that population a lot. So yeah, I haven't thought about that, but that's probably true. Yeah.
I'm interested in the process in which these alternatives were formed, because there seems to be a pretty big gap between C and D in terms of kind of commitment to reaching 25 versus commitment to reaching 200, and then the span in which that project is going to go forth. Was there kind of any more intermediate evaluation? I mean, I also don't know that much about kind of the succession of a population and like how long it truly takes to establish. Mm-hmm. Like even if you introduced any number below, say like 150, it would still take 60 to 100 years.
Yeah. I mean, their decision-making process was that they looked at different recovery efforts and saw what strategies succeeded and what didn't, and then took a lot of different, you know, okay, let's have one no option, let's have one extreme, and let's have a couple in between. So I'm sure that they probably considered having some in the middle. And just to note, this is all part of the draft impact statement. So they had a period of public comment that lasted until I think May this year, where they were collecting comments from the public. And I don't, do you know how many comments they got? They got somewhere in the neighborhood of like over 100,000 comments. And like the vast majority of them weren't from the state. They were from out of state, different conservation groups and environmental groups and hunting groups and all sorts of different stakeholders that pitched in. And now that they've gotten all those comments, they'll revise these alternatives. So they might say, oh, well, you know, everyone said that they really wanted C, but they wanted a little bit more, and no one wants D. So maybe they'll adjust that to be a little bit more. It just depends. And they might totally ignore the public comments, too. You never know. Typically, they factor them in, because a lot of the success of these projects is rooted in public perception. Yes?
If grizzlies are so sensitive to air pollution, I don't think we have any business trying to reintroduce them when we are progressively having worse and worse wildfires in the whole western corner of the United States. I really think the government should try to solve that problem a little more, put them out sooner or something. I don't know. But that's global warming in a big way, and grizzlies should not be introduced into an area that's having the problems that we're having right now.
I think those are problems that are inherent and are going to become more inherent over time. I don't think we can change that. I want to make a comment because I live in grizzly country and I've worked with grizzlies for many, many years. The small town that I live in, Shoto, is right on the edge of the Continental Divide and part of the greater continental ecosystem. We have grizzly bears. There are times that we have not been able to allow students out on the playground at recess because we have a grizzly bear close to the fence line that establishes the playground. And I would say that 90% of the people in our community accept that as it's just the way it is. We now have bears where the bears used to just be in the mountains, and that's where you would see them. Now we see them 80, 90 miles out on the plains, as far east as Loma, Montana, which is beyond Great Falls. That's their natural habitat, and to me, it's such a huge indicator that we have a very, very healthy, viable population, because they are it's younger bears that are being forced out by the more dominant bears, and they're actually denning away from the mountains. So we see them, gosh, in the spring when they're following the new growth grass, we, on a yearly basis, on my runs out in the prairies west of Shoto, I've seen numerous grizzlies, sows with cubs, young two-year-olds that are moving along the riparian areas, and we never have an incident. I just saw a picture that our the new principal in Shoto posted of a grizzly in her front yard. And yet that's not a huge deal. So I have a problem with this incredible concern about the ferocity of grizzly bears and how dangerous they are. they no more want to have an interaction with you than you want to have an interaction with them. And having dealt with multiple bear incidents, from maulings, severe maulings, minor maulings, to deaths caused by bears, with the exception of one, it was man's stupidity, carelessness, that precipitated the mauling. It wasn't the bear's problem. The bear was purely reacting under its pure basic instincts. And it wasn't because it was hungry. So this fear is so... I see it all every summer working in the park. And yet I see people who are in Glacier Park purely to see a grizzly. It just fascinates me when I can see a grizzly up on the hillside right next to our campground, and I get out the two spotting scopes I have and two or three pair of binoculars, and there will be 50 people who are so thrilled at seeing a grizzly bear. It thrills me. I've seen hundreds. I've interacted with hundreds. To watch a boar grizzly, a 500 or 600 pound boar, feeding on ants under a rock that three of us couldn't pick up. And he's reaching down with his claws, and he lifts it up, backhands it, feeds on the ants, and then puts the rock back down. They are astounding animals. They are mesmerizing. And it's something that I'm so in favor of their reintroduction that you probably gathered that.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Has this process moved along far enough? Is this a possibility of flowing through, the Washington D.C. mess, or is this something that's going to be given up? We're not going to do this, and we're not going to fund that. We're not going to. Is this a problem?
That's a great question. So, the park has different endangered species on their list that they need to be concerned about, and for a long time, the grizzly bear has just been pretty low on that list because the population was lower, and they just didn't really think there was much of a hope of that population recovering. And then for some reason, in the last couple of years, it's just shot to the top, or one of the top lists. And that, I think, is really interesting. And I don't know exactly why. Last year, actually about this time, we were in Stehekin for their apple festival that they have every fall, where they pick up apples from one of the historic orchards. And a bunch of folks from Holden were sitting at dinner at the lodge there, and this guy came up holding two bottles of wine and sat down and goes, "Holden, I love you! Here's some wine!" And it turns out that he had been on, his dad had been on the Holden board a long time ago, and he had been up to Holden many times, and he was there that weekend for a meeting with the National Park, basically the interpreter, the person who's in charge of all the interpretation and outreach programs and things like that, and this effort to reintroduce them. And we got invited to sit down with them and talk about the reintroduction of the grizzly bear. And it turns out that his organization is a charity that contributes a huge amount of funding to the national parks in Washington State. And all of the folks from that charity were really excited about the grizzly bear. And I'm curious as to if a lot of this effort is not hinged on the fact that they say, we want the grizzly bear, so we'll give you a lot more funding if you do this effort, which could be a positive thing in actually having this go through. It's interesting, again, to see how money will influence that process, but it sounded like there was a lot of funding to support this effort, and that it might not be as big of a concern from from a federal level to push that along. It's pretty standard to have a process where you're, you know, you get the comments and you're reviewing all of them for a while, and then you finally come up with the final situation. The same process we went through to get the mine remediation project, where we submitted public comments, and it basically took about a year to process all of those and really get the concrete ideas out there for, you know, this is what's going to happen. So I would expect to see a decision being made sometime in the next several months. And then I would imagine that they'd try and do that effort next summer, whatever option they choose. Yeah.
In Montana, there is a lot of controversy about the reintroduction of the wolf. The wolves, and I only generally aware of this, but it seems that the ranchers are on one side and the environmentalists are on the other side because of livestock. Does the reintroduction of the grizzly have any implications as far as livestock is concerned?
Ask about apples also, or fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to approach it from the standpoint of what's happened within our community. Yeah, there is some degree of predation. You get a rogue bear, and it will go into a herd of sheep, and will indiscriminately kill 50 sheep and not eat any of them. That happens once in a great, great while. Every once in a while, a calf gets killed. The interesting thing for me is the ranchers, the majority of all the ranchers, with the exception of one, have banded together in support of the grizzly bear. They have put, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of acres into easements to help protect, in conservation easements, to protect the environment that the grizzly bear needs for its survival. So they have come to accept the fact that the grizzly bear is an integral part of the environment where we live. And it's amazing on Facebook in the spring, the number of photographs that farmers and ranchers have of grizzly bears walking right through their front yard. And they're thrilled by it. So I think the amount, degree of predation, and how many millions of acres are we talking about?
6 million.
6 million?
Yeah.
Okay, 6 million acres in the North Cascades. Glacier Park is 1 million acres. You go all the way down, you're looking at an area probably the size of the North Cascades. And they're talking about introducing 200 grizzlies. Yeah, you've got apple orchards, et cetera. You've got all kinds of desirable food. And you may see grizzly bears in your orchard. Just leave it alone. It's not coming in there, and it's not going to ruin your economy because it eats a couple hundred apples out of hundreds of thousands that you produce.
How many grizzlies are there in your area? Glacier ecosystem, I'll call it.
Looking at Glacier, we have 500 to 600 grizzlies and probably 800 black bear. But you need what I try to impress on people is we're talking about an ecosystem. Glacier Park is not an ecosystem unto itself. Right. It runs all the way up into Canada and way south. So these bears are moving back and forth, and they're moving north and south, east and west. So their territory really, and I hate to use the term territory because they really aren't a territorial animal. They don't defend a territory. They might defend a food source, a berry patch or a carcass, but they're not going to defend 400 acres of land just because that's what they want for themselves. I forgot where I was going with that completely. Did that answer your question?
Well, yeah, you answered my question about how many bears are in there. It's a lot more than we're introducing here.
How many are there in the North Carolina undivided ecosystem? Probably half again as many as there are in Glacier Park.
Maybe a couple more comments.
Just kind of with the talk of competing parties and hunting licenses, and like you mentioned commons, is there any kind of caveat to this proposal that like should X level of bears be reached that it'll be opened up to kind of the future licensing of hunting of grizzlies up here? I know like we're just in the middle of high hunt for, and so I guess Neil, if you could speak a little bit to kind of controversies in Montana of the grizzly being removed from the endangered species list and kind of what that has opened up. And I don't know whether it's kind of more specific to each population or whether that's a national level policy now. At what point does it become not a matter of just kind of species protection, but also maybe opening up to hunting? So is
can,
there any
can you condense that question?
Yeah. Is there any two sentences? This process that is about contingent of possible permission of hunting in the North Cascades, and can you speak a little bit more to the controversy currently in Montana about removal from the endangered species list and possible issuing of hunting licenses?
I
still no.
So I mean, the idea is that if you're on the endangered species list or you're an animal on the endangered species list at the federal level, then you've got to get off that list before you can be hunted, generally. So going forward, if they were to restore the population to a certain level, and I don't know what that number would be here, if I think it might be 200 or 250, then they'd say, hey, there's enough bears. If we hunt a couple of them, they'll still be able to be healthy and we can open it up. Within Montana, my understanding is that there's controversy over the recent delisting of the Yellowstone population, specifically, because of things like Neil's mentioned, because they might not have a diverse enough gene pool. And by opening it up to hunting, you're not going to let that population grow to have that resiliency in a maybe greater gene pool. That, you know, yes, they delisted it, but that number is not good enough. They just kind of arbitrarily decided that, you know, X number of bears is good enough, and then we'll open it up to hunting because they want to open it up. On the flip side, people might say, hey, this is a great, you know, this bear population's, it's up to what we want it to be. This is a great victory for conservation, and wow, now we can open it up to hunting, and those hunters will support the conservation of it by paying a lot of money and wanting to have bears to hunt. But then you might say, well, you know, if there were 50,000 bears across the whole West, we're not even close to getting that. Why are we letting anyone hunt them until we get back to that full population, right? So, I mean, the controversy goes on, and I'm sure there are other perspectives beyond that, that I think that is a pretty controversial move to have delisted them and open it up to hunting.
And what, you know, if they open it up, it will be to X number of bears. Let's say they open it up to 8. And once they reach that 8, then whether you have a permit or not, it will be cut off. But within that 8, they may say, once we reach 3 females, we will cut off the hunting. So they're, by delisting them, they're still going to protect the population so that you don't have 8 females taken out of the population, because their breeding cycle is so extended. It takes a long time to develop a population. They've got to be 5 years old before they're bred. They breed every 3 to 4 years, so you don't have very many new bears coming in, cubs coming into the population very quickly. So, yeah, they're going to be pretty rigid controls, and when it's cut off, it's cut off. And if you're in the backcountry and you don't hear about it, and you kill a female and it's the fourth one, you're going to be in trouble because you are responsible for knowing. That's kind of how, that's one of the means they use for controlling how many bears are removed from a population.
Well, I think we've gone past an hour. So I think we'll end now. But if y'all have any questions or comments or anything for either of us, or just want to chat afterwards, that'd be great.
What was the Holden board's
position? Oh, yeah, that's the thing. Darius, do you want to say it?
No.
I can, okay.
You go right ahead.
So basically, Holden, it's actually a really long thing, so I won't read it all. I didn't even bring it with me. But Holden was a proponent of alternative B, so introducing bears in support of the reintroduction effort, but being really cautious. And the main idea is that with alternative B, if that's successful, then you can just segue right into alternative C and sort of improve and speed up that process. And I thought it was kind of interesting, some of the phrases in there, one of them was taking bits from our mission. So things like welcoming all into the wilderness.
Includes the grizzly.
And grizzly bears and animals also are that. And holding up such core values as place and community and ecology, and that, you know, if we're truly going to support sort of this place, that we would support a historical part of that biology as well. But they also said that they wanted the grizzly bears to be introduced from basically the farthest place away from the village, so in the release areas. And that's actually, a lot of folks really, for many good reasons, want the bears to be released in the most remote place, which there are even more remote places within the North Cascades than where we are here.
And the only thing I would add in the discussion I remember is the fear of the unknown is with all this, and to start with a lesser amount would ease us into having knowledge about the bear and be more comfortable with it versus all at once.
Yeah.
And that would be the only otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming. Tonight, after Vespers, I'll be holding a forum in here to talk about wildfire and sort of our perceptions of wildfire. So for Holden, fire is a huge thing recently because we almost lost the village to a fire, and we hadn't had a fire in over 100 years in this stretch of valley.
And that's at 6, aren't we?
At 6?
The video is at 6.
The video is at 6, but then after
right,
the rest
right. That's the introduction to what you're going to be saying.
Yeah, exactly. And then this fire season has been a pretty severe one, especially for folks in Washington, Montana, British Columbia, Oregon recently. So if you're interested in that discussion, we'll be here, and it'll just be facilitated discussion, so not a presentation, but just a chance for us to talk. Thanks.